Good morning to all of you. It's good to have you this morning. So glad that you're here and interested in studying from the book of Acts. We're in the 17th chapter, as most of you know. The 17th chapter of the book of Acts is a fascinating chapter, as I use that word, I guess probably over much. But when we study about the city of Athens, and when we get into the 18th chapter and begin to study about the city of Corinth, very intriguing places. And then the 19th chapter, we'll be talking about the city of Ephesus. But some of the history of these cities is particularly interesting to me, especially as we look at the approach that the Apostle Paul made in trying to teach these people. And one of the things that we've noted in many of our studies is that in Romans 1, verses 16 and 17, the gospel is God's power unto salvation to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. We note that it is within the gospel that God's plan to make man righteous is made known. Jesus instructed the apostles in what we often refer to as the Great Commission in Matthew's account to go make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. We see in the book of Acts the history of them carrying that out. The Holy Spirit came upon them in Acts chapter 2, and they began to preach the gospel to every creature, beginning with the Jew and then to the Gentile. We note that the beginning of the gospel was to the Jew in Acts chapter 2, the beginning of the gospel to the Gentiles in Acts chapter 10, and now we have progressed to where we are studying of the preaching of the gospel on Paul's second preaching tour in Macedonia and then on down into Achaia. And that's where we're going to begin our study this morning. We have on the board a map of the second preaching trip of the Apostle Paul. We've noted in our previous studies that the first preaching tour began from Antioch in the province of Syria. Now we have him being sent out again by the church in Antioch in the province of Syria, going up through portions of Asia to Troas, where we saw in Acts the 16th chapter, he saw the man from Macedonia, which that's this province up here, saying, come over into Macedonia and help us. Paul travels then to Philippi, Amphipolis, Apolloni, and then to Thessalonica, and then on down to Berea. And in our study today, we're going to be studying about his work in Athens. And I want you to open your Bibles, not only to Acts the 17th chapter, but if you'll note, beginning with me in verse 16. Acts chapter 17, verse 16. Now, to bring us up to speed, we note that Paul has essentially been thrown out of the city of Thessalonica. Those in the synagogue in Thessalonica were prejudiced. They wouldn't listen to what he had to say for the most part. When he traveled down to Berea, we've noted that the Bereans had a great deal more integrity than those in Thessalonica because they were willing to study. The text tells us that they searched the scriptures daily to find out whether or not the things they were being taught were true. And that's an admirable quality. We note that they received the word, verse 11, with all readiness of mind. That's important. How you receive what's being taught. And when he came to the city of Athens, however, we've got an entirely different circumstance existing in the city of Athens. You'll note in verse 16, it says, now while Paul waited for them, that is, for Silas and Timothy, having sent word back that they should come with all speed, his spirit was provoked within him as he beheld the city full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons and in the marketplace every day with them that met him. An interesting thought just here is, well, a couple of things. One is Paul's spirit was stirred within him. When he saw the city of Athens and saw that it was filled with idols, what reaction did he have? We don't use the expression stirred in spirit much anymore. But what reaction did he have when he saw all this? What did it do to him?
It bothered him.
It bothered him. We might even call it righteous indignation or made him angry to see such vast ignorance. And we're going to talk about why that existed in the city of Athens, especially to this degree in the city of Athens. Yes, Randy?
New American Standard says his spirit was being provoked.
Yes, just terribly upset. Now, when you go into an environment where there is such vast ignorance, he couldn't be quiet. We might use that expression as the New American Standard uses the word provoke. He couldn't remain quiet and see all of this. Having sent for Silas and Timothy to come with all speed, what's he going to do while he waits? Just sit and twiddle his thumbs? Can't do that. That's not an option. Here's an opportunity to teach these people so that they will no longer be ignorant. Now, we want to see some of the causes of that ignorance and some of the manifestations of that ignorance as it existed in Athens. But before we do that, I want to look briefly at verse 17, the first part of it. He reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons. We've noted when he came into the city of Thessalonica that that was his established practice, to go into the Jewish synagogue, where there were those who were familiar with the law of Moses. They would be familiar with the Old Testament prophecies concerning the coming of the Lord, concerning the coming of the Lord's kingdom, concerning the sacrifice that he would offer, as we can read in Isaiah 53. All of this he would have certainly good cause to believe that the Jews in the synagogue would be familiar with. Now, the Jews in the synagogue in Thessalonica, we noted, were overcome with their own prejudice. They just wouldn't listen. This is what we believe, and don't confuse us with the facts. We've talked about who the devout Greeks may have been. They may have been either those who were perhaps Jewish proselytes, those who had adopted the Jewish religion, or very simply someone perhaps like Cornelius, who had been taught the things that were right and had a reverence for the existence of God. And so Paul began with these who had a familiarity with the Scriptures and a familiarity with the existence of God. But we note as he continued his teaching in Athens in verse 17, it says, in the marketplace every day with them that met him. Now, when you think of the marketplace, perhaps we don't have marketplaces in Lancaster like they had there, but it would be a very busy place where people are buying and selling produce or animals or various sundry things. It would be a very busy place. And people would come there not only and buy stuff or sell stuff, but as you can imagine, all kinds of conversations would begin in an environment like that. Paul, in the marketplace, begins to converse with these people.
I was going to say that if we just go back a chapter and look at the marketplace in Thessalonica, we can see that that's where they were dragged before the ruler in Philippi.
Yes.
So that's where they were dragged before the ruler. So it was also a public meeting place.
That's right. That's right. A lot of people here. Yeah. And no doubt those who were in positions of power and authority were to be found in places like this. And this is where Paul is. And it tells us that he's reasoning with those in the synagogue, and he's reasoning with those in the marketplace. Now, the idea of reasoning, we've talked about that already in this chapter, where he reasoned with those in Thessalonica, opening and alleging from the Scriptures that it behooved the Christ to suffer and to die and to be raised on the third day. When you factor in the element of reasoning, what are you doing?
A logical conversation and exchange.
All right. That's right. It's a logical conversation. And in the city of Athens, you would expect that reasoning in the Jewish synagogue to be reasoning from the Old Testament Scriptures. But in the marketplace, you wouldn't necessarily conclude that these people are familiar with the Old Testament prophecies and such things as that, because we have a Greek environment, a Greek city, which we're going to see many manifestations of as our study progresses. But what we want to note just here is he's reasoning with them. Now, I want you to see the difference in reasoning with those who are familiar with the Old Testament Scriptures and reasoning with those who are well-informed, let's say, as far as Greek culture and Greek intelligence or learning is concerned. There's a different approach. And we want to note that vividly in this text. In verse 18, it tells us, "And certain also of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers encountered him." In our last study, I asked the question, what is a philosopher? And we noted that philosophy or a philosopher is, it's a way of thinking. It's kind of a starting place. A way of thought, and you go from there and you reason to something else. But if your starting place is not sound, you're not going to wind up with the truth, are you? Now, Paul is reasoning with these folks who are philosophers. They have a means of thinking or a way of thinking that is in many ways, shall I say, unique or peculiar. It was then and is quite common now. And we're going to be talking about some of the manifestations of that. But when you think of the city of Athens, a place that's filled with learning and a means of thinking that attempted to answer some questions. Now, I dare say that when you talk with somebody who doesn't have a Bible, not religious, not been introduced to anything at all about spiritual things, these same questions are on their mind. They've thought about them. They may not dominate their thinking, but it's on their mind. What's the nature of the universe? I mean, you look around about you, the question is going to come up. How did all this come to be? You look at the beautiful things that exist. Folks have to try to explain it somehow. And then the very existence of man, is there any purpose for my existence? Why am I here? And then the question about truth. We noted that Pilate asked that question, what is truth? As if it's not easily determined. And then that leads us to the next question, how do you determine what is right and what is wrong? Now, this is a question that you feel free to answer if you would like. When you're talking with somebody who is very worldly, has no concept of God, doesn't know anything about the character or the nature of God, and let me say it this way. Does that person have any kind of a sense of what's right and what's wrong? Generally, there are things that are accepted and there are things that are rejected. But it doesn't begin with what's morally or ethically right or wrong. Now, how then is that standard determined of what's right and wrong?
What everyone thinks.
That's right. Now, that appeals to philosophy because that's a way of thinking. That's what that is. And when Paul went to the city of Athens, he encountered that. People who had no understanding of the nature of God. And yet they're grasping for answers to these questions, and they've answered them, at least somewhat to their satisfaction. Now that raises the question about, well, how did they approach answering these kind of questions with the way of thinking that they had? Well, let's talk about who these people were. First of all, it says that he encountered the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. The Epicurean philosophers. Who were they? Well, they were a sect of philosophers that were named after Epicurus, who lived about 300 years before Christ. Now, the thing that we want to take home about the Epicureans, it's not going to be our purpose this morning to study in detail the thinking of the Epicureans and the Stoic philosophers. But to get a general idea, I think is crucial to this context, absolutely crucial to understanding the approach that Paul makes in presenting God to them. Because, you see, the Epicureans denied that the world was created by God. Now, does that mean they had no concept of any kind of deity? Well, what was in Athens? The city was filled with idols. What does that suggest to you? Did they have any kind of a concept of something greater than man? Well, yes. But to understand the person and nature of God, they did not. Now, if you deny that the world was created by God, then how did the world come into existence, or did it come into existence? Perhaps it was just here all the time. You see, if you deny that the world was created by God, what other choice do you have? How many choices are there?
Either was or wasn't.
Either was or wasn't, well, that's right. But either God created it or it wasn't created. It always was. Now, the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers had that in common. You see, they didn't start with God created the world. They started with the world, and the world created God. Randy?
I was just going to say the popular evolutionist theory is there's no God and it created itself.
Yeah. Now, so what we're looking at in Acts 17 is what we experience today. Anything new? Oh, it's the same thing we're studying in Acts 17. That's the world that Paul came into in the city of Athens. Like today, where the learning of the world is, we start with that which is material. It has always been. And the existence of God, you see, the world created God. That's where that came from. Well, that's what the Epicureans believed. And frankly, that's what the Stoics believed too. They just had a little different twist on things. But that's where they started. Now, if you deny that the world was created by God, then you also are forced to the conclusion that the world that is, God doesn't have anything to do with it. There is no providence of God. He's not involved with the day-to-day affairs that exist in the world. And another thought that the Epicureans had is when you're dead, you're kind of like Rover. You're just dead all over. That's the end of it. You see. So when we think about the immortality of the soul and believe that. Now, let's take that way of thinking. I'm going to go in reverse here. Back to this chart. When you believe that the universe is eternal, man came along as a product of the universe, materialistic as such, and now you have the existence of man. What's his purpose? What do you do? Why are you here? What do you use your life for? Do you have any difficulty when you start with the existence of material things? That's where you start. Now when you come to man, do you have any purpose?
Whatever you decide.
Whatever you decide. That's your purpose. Now, this question, what is truth? Is there any absolute standard when you start with things that are material?
Whatever you decide.
Whatever you decide, yeah. Now, how do you determine what's right or wrong then? Whatever you decide, whatever makes you happy so that you don't have a life filled with turmoil and always upset and mad and angry, that sort of thing. You don't want that. So, what determines what's right and wrong is you and how you feel about things. Yeah, you're number one. Yeah. Friend?
In essence, it's self-deity.
Now, let's talk for just a little bit about the Stoics. Sometimes when we see the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers, we think, well, they're on opposite ends of the planet, you know, because they're contrasted. Well, not necessarily. They were different, but not all that much different. They had a different way of thinking about things. Their idea was that everything is guided by fate. And the idea of reasoning. You think it through and you come to a logical conclusion and that's where you are. That's why these people, the Epicurean and Stoics, were so interested in listening to Paul. Now, we hadn't heard what he has to say. In fact, we've never heard anyone say what he has to say. So this is new. And the purpose of our existence is to learn some new thing. So we want to see what this babbler, and we'll talk about that in a moment, has to say. But notice further that these believe that, that virtue is really the purpose of your life. You do good things, then in this life you reap the consequence of doing good things, so that's your reward. But what about life after death? What about judgment by God and a definite standard of absolute truth and a definite standard of morality, right and wrong? You see, they didn't believe that either, did they? That was the way that they thought. Now, granted, they agreed that passions and affections that you might have, you need to control those kind of things because there might be in this life some pretty bad consequences come upon you because of decisions that you make. But do you see how that this affects this way of thinking? How it affects the standard of what is morally acceptable and what morally is to be rejected. And that's what Paul found in the city of Athens, and I want to suggest to you that this way of thinking did not just exist in Athens. This was the culture of the day. That's what he found in Corinth. We'll talk about that more. That's what he found in Ephesus. The same way of thinking existed. And to say that these folks were pantheists, or pantheism characterized their way of thinking, that's the view that the world is either identical to God or an expression of God's nature. In other words, have you ever talked with folks who say, well, you know, when I go into the mountains, that's my church because God's He's in these mountains. And then there are folks who say, well, you know, God's out here. He's in the ocean. I just really like being out at the coast because God's there. I had an occasion to talk with a young man one time. He was about half nuts, but he stewed his brain on drugs. But to illustrate the point, he said, God is in the paneling on the walls. God, He's in the pews, in the pad that's on the pews. That's where God is. Now, I know that's perhaps an overstatement, but it does illustrate the point that God is in all of these things. Now, what have you done? You've placed God in a physical existence in material things. And this is somewhat the attitude that these philosophers have. Now, when you begin with that kind of a concept of the nature of God, as you've pointed out already, the standard you live by is what pleases you. Now, I want to ask you, brethren, how is that really any different from the world in which we live? It's difficult for me to communicate, I guess, as effectively as I would like to, that there are different ways of thinking. People start at different places, and I think sometimes when we have been a Christian for a long time, or perhaps our parents are members of the Lord's church and we've been exposed to Bible teaching all of our life, it's hard to think that, you know, there are folks just don't start there. They don't think this way. When we emphasize such passages as Colossians 3, beginning about verse 1 through 3, set your mind on the things that are above, not on the things that are upon this earth. And then the statement of the Lord about where our treasure is, lay up treasure in heaven. And so, in Matthew chapter 6, when we look at passages like that, we understand that because there's two different ways of thinking that we're aware of. But sometimes, and I fear greatly that this is something that we're not as effectively as we perhaps should or could teach to our children. Because they're immersed in this kind of thinking every day at school. Their friends are immersed in this kind of thinking. The things that are done for social activities are prompted by this kind of thinking. And so often when our children are reared in an environment that is so overwhelmed with people that do not believe that there's any other way to think. This is the way everybody thinks. Perhaps our children grow up thinking that too. There's really not another way to think. Everybody thinks like this. No, there is another way to think. And Paul is trying to get these people in Athens to see that the way they've been thinking about things, their philosophy, is not right. It's not accurate. Now, they prided themselves on their intellectualism, upon their reasoning and their logic. Paul is not in the city of Athens to debate the issue. I want us to see that. These philosophers would often get together and they would butt heads over their philosophies. Paul is not there to debate the issue. He's not there to argue with them. He's there to tell them fact after fact after fact. And he establishes the facts as so, and if I may use the expression, it blows their mind. They've never heard anything like this before. And so many of them want to hear him more. Some of them perhaps are persuaded by the things that he has to say. Now, before we proceed any further, I think it's crucial to the context to understand the environment of Athens. Does anybody have a question at this point? Or a comment? Randy?
I have heard it described, the difference as to, I'm not trying to get ahead of it here, the difference between Athens and Corinth, for those of us that are familiar with England, it would be like Paul going in Athens to Corinth, like going from Oxford, England to London.
Perhaps so.
That Athens was a college town, yeah, pretty much now, a center of learning, not a political environment. Corinth was a bustling political center.
Right. I've never been to London. I've never been to Athens or Corinth. So all I can do is tell you what I've studied, but that gives me an impression of what Paul encountered when he came to this city. Now, another thing that I think paints a picture for us about the city. Let's deal with this chart while I have it up here. The Epicureans would take the philosophy, eat, drink, be merry, for tomorrow we die. What gives me pleasure, that's what I'll do. What satisfies me, that's fine. As long as it doesn't create problems in my life, that becomes the determination of the right and the wrong, you see. And the Stoics, they were stern in their views of virtue. You know, if we do this, this, and this, then we'll reap good things in this life from it. And their thinking was similar in some respects to those of the Pharisees who prided themselves in their own righteousness. We do this, this, and this, and this, and so we're good folks, and you're not, because we hold to a much higher standard than you do. We're more righteous or virtuous. But the thing that we want to emphasize is that in both schools of thought, their concept of the eternity of matter precluded any idea that it was created by an eternal God. Now, if you begin with the existence of matter, that matter is eternal, then when you die, who are you going to answer to?
Nobody.
Nobody. So when you die, there's nothing after this life. There's no final judgment. And so the Greeks' concept of morality, or something that is sinful, just no concept at all of that way of thinking. Again, let me emphasize that the determining factor of whether something is right or wrong is the effect that it has on you. It's not necessarily to answer to a moral standard or to answer to the judgment of God. Now, talking to people in a Bible class, does that way of thinking just kind of blow your mind? Say, well, there are people like that, Nora. Yeah, there are. And that's what Paul encountered in the city of Athens and really other places as well. And that's what you encounter, is it not? When you talk with friends and neighbors, that sort of thing about spiritual things. You see, if we can get people, as Paul did, and we're going to discuss in some detail the sermon that he presents to these folks, but if we can get people to understand that there is a God, that's a beginning place. You begin with the existence of God. Now, in our classes on evidence, we often start with evidence for the existence of God. And there's a reason for that. Because if indeed we can be convinced that there is a God, then that demands accountability. But if you deny the existence of God, then there is no accountability. Bottom line, that's it. That's where these folks were in the city of Athens. And what we want to see is how Paul approached them. Now, here's our questions again. What's the nature of the universe? Well, they'd say it's eternal. What's the purpose of man? You do what you want to. What makes you happy and doesn't cause you grief in terms of consequence? What is truth? Well, that's whatever you think. And then how do you determine what's right or wrong? Well, that's dependent on how the consequences affect me. Now, you see, when you exclude God, that's where you are with these major questions affecting your life. Now, when Paul came into the city of Athens, we might note that the city itself, I have a chart on here somewhere, I'm not sure of the order or the placement of it in the order, but the city of Athens was about 2 miles inland from the port. And that's important to us because to get to this city where Paul is, he had to walk that 2 mile road to get up there. And what did he see as he walked along the road?
Shrines and idols.
Shrines and idols. That's right. So much so that, as you pointed out, he was provoked to see their allegiance to these things. Now, I've seen pictures of ancient shrines and idols and so forth in some other places, not in Athens, but seen pictures from other places. And the shrines or the idols might have been smaller things, sometimes maybe the size of this table. And people would bow down before it and worship it. And when they talked about the altars being broken down, sometimes you would see those things and they'd have big cracks in them. They were, for all practical purposes, destroyed. But when Paul went to the city of Athens, this is the kind of thing that he saw. The Greek Parthenon sitting up here on this hill. And here is another picture of the Acropolis in Athens. Now, when you just let your eyes gaze at these a little bit. I didn't put these pictures up here necessarily for entertainment purposes. That's not the point. But to show you the investment of time, the investment of energy, the investment of money that these people in Athens have placed in these things. Look at this. Now, these are the ancient ruins that are still there in the city of Athens. And just to get an idea, here's a person standing here. And you compare that. This thing, I've studied that a little bit as far as the architectural design of the Acropolis in Athens. That in itself is just amazing to study how the building is constructed. The angles and so forth and some of that kind of thing. But look at the size of it. You know, when you talk about architecture and you talk about sitting down and with the blueprints and drawing all this out, you've got some of the most learned men in the world that put their thinking into how to build this. And the financing, as Randy pointed out, how much a thing like this would cost. And then you put inside it a shrine or a carving of stone or gold or some other precious metal in here, and that represents Athena, which was the daughter of Zeus, and I forget their mother's name. But you see the relationship that they had with these gods. These gods and their relationship to each other is like people and their relationships with each other. You know, Zeus married this woman, and the product of, or one of the products of their relationship was Athena, and she was the goddess of, the patron goddess of the city, but she was the goddess of war and that kind of thing. And so we've got all of these various gods and goddesses represented in the city of Athens in such lucrative manifestations as what you see here. Just incredible, precious things that they've spent their money on and their time and so forth. And of course, if you've studied Greek mythology, you know that Zeus is the chief god, and this is what's left of the temple of Zeus there in the city of Athens. And having said all of that, this is what Paul saw when he came into the city, and when he began to converse with these learned men. He's conversing with men that begin with the universe, not God, but of all things, what does he find? He finds an altar with the inscription to the unknown God. And I want you to look, if you will, in your Bible, there in verse 23. I'm going to read that, and then we're going to go back and fill in the blanks. In verse 22, beginning, it says, "And Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, Ye men of Athens, in all things I perceive that you are very religious, for as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription to an unknown God. What therefore you worship in ignorance, this I set forth unto you." Now, sometimes when we read this, our emphasis is upon the singular word God, as Paul sees all of these manifestations of their belief in multiple gods. I'm not convinced that that's the point of contrast, though that is a point that is to be established, and Paul establishes that in this context. But I think the point of emphasis is upon this word unknown. You don't know who God is. Not only do you have a misconception manifested by these multiple gods, but you've got this altar over here about a God you know nothing about. Now, the thing I found strange in studying this is this word unknown comes to us from this Greek word. Do you see another word that we use in English that comes from this word?
Agnostic.
Uh-huh. This word means ignorant. Just ignorant. People don't know. Now, when you're talking with someone who is an agnostic, what's he acknowledging? Well, that wasn't exactly my first choice, but yes, that's it. He's trying to say, I don't know. I don't know what to believe. That's what he's trying to say. But yeah, he's saying he's ignorant. Because the evidence is overwhelming. And he's just ignorant of the evidence. Won't accept it for one reason or the other. Now, we could talk and will a little bit more about that. But what I want you to see is Paul's dealing with this idea of what's unknown to these folks. Now, let's back up in the text just a little bit and see the interest that these have. In verse 18, when it speaks of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers that encountered him, it tells us that some said, "What would this babbler say? He seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached Jesus and the resurrection." Two things, or perhaps three, I want to take from this. One is their interest in what this babbler would say. That word babbler comes to us from a rather interesting word that would be translated seed picker. Have you ever noticed a bird or maybe a chicken out in the chicken lot eating? What do they do? Yeah, over here and then over there, over here and over there. Seed picker. Now, what are these folks, these Epicurean and Stoic philosophers, what are they doing? They're picking up bits here, bits there, a little bit over here, a little bit over there. This has all affected their thinking. And they think, well, hey, we haven't heard what Paul's got to say. We're going to pick up a little bit more there. So we want to see what this seed picker has to say. Because that's what Paul is. He gets a little here, a little there.
This translation has there's a marginal reference next to the word idle or rattle babbler.
Uh-huh.
It says one who makes his living by picking up scraps.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and that's what they did. As you see in that parenthetical statement in verse 21. Now all the Athenians and the strangers sojourning there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. Seed picking. They're just picking up bits and pieces here and yonder. Picking up scraps. And they think that this is valuable information. It's junk. I had a study with a fellow down the street from the building here some time ago. And we were trying to study what the Bible has to say. And he brought out a notebook as evidence of his study. And in this notebook, he had taken notes of all kinds of numbers and statements and all of this. And he was trying to put all this together so that he would know the end of the world, when that's going to happen. And I thought of all things. You know, it was obvious he'd given a whole lot of thought to what was in that notebook. But it was a complete waste of his time. Just a complete waste of his time. Picking up scraps, and he thought it was valuable. But yeah, that's the idea here. Richard and I studied with a fellow that was a neighbor of his a few years ago, and the experience itself was worth a lot. Because this man, like these are described as very religious or very superstitious, I believe that that man intended, at least, to be very religious. He had all kinds of books in his library. His desk was just, well, looked as bad, at least, as mine, but with stuff that he'd been reading and studying. And one of the statements that I found remarkable that he made was he believed that Paul was not an apostle, that Paul was a false prophet. Well, now, that had my attention. And I've asked folks since that experience, well, how would you go about to establish that Paul was indeed an apostle? Well, most folks would answer that by saying, well, I'd go over here to the book of Acts, and we'd read about his conversion, read about what he was and what he became and how he suffered and all of this kind of thing for the things that he taught to be true. Well, that's right. That's what we presented to that fellow, too. And he said, you know, I don't believe that what Luke wrote in the book of Acts was without being defiled. Yeah, I believe that Paul influenced Luke to write that. Now, that just makes all kinds of sense. So what you just, in a wave of the hand done, you just waved the whole book of Acts out of the Bible. But not just Acts. You just waved the whole Gospel of Luke right out of the Bible. All right, so I can't believe the Gospel of Luke, and I can't believe the book of Acts. Now, how do you establish that Paul was an apostle? Aha! Well, you'd turn over to 2 Peter, wouldn't you? Yeah, that's exactly where you'd go. You'd go to 2 Peter. At the conclusion of that, you'll note that the Apostle Peter said that our beloved brother Paul wrote some things that were hard to be understood and so forth and so on. Well, I don't believe that Peter wrote 2 Peter. Okay, so we just eliminated the whole book of 2 Peter. Now, anything that provided any kind of information about Paul, this man just discredited. He just, in essence, dispelled that from the Bible. That's not, I don't believe that. Now, let me present this to you this way. Suppose you're trying to teach a man that provides at least the appearance that he's interested in truth. He's asking this question, what is truth? And it's right in front of him. There it is, black and white. Just read it. He said, I don't believe that. I want to read it somewhere else. All right, you go somewhere else. Oh, no, I don't believe that. We go somewhere else. Well, what have you done with the Bible? Let's just throw the whole thing away. And I told him before we left, I said, you know, I really believe that you're searching. But your mind has been so corrupted by all this junk that you filled it with, like these Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. Your mind is so corrupted with the junk that you've been reading that you wouldn't know the truth if it jumped off the page and bit you. Now, that's just the way that that is. And the very thing that you're searching for and searching diligently for is right in front of you, and you won't read it. End of story. You know, that was the end of our study, of course, but that's
the man came back from the dead and wouldn't read it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Richard?
It seemed like by the time we were done talking with him that he only accepted portions of one book of the entire New Testament or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, we were boiled down to nothing.
I thought, well, you might as well just be a Jew then. I thought he indicated that that was not without reason also.
Yeah, but you see the problem. You see why when Paul came into the city of Athens, his spirit was provoked within him. And then when he begins to converse with these people, you just want to bat your head against the wall. Now, he was not the first, of course. We read of the Lord in John chapter 6 who performed miracles, and the people saw the miracles that he performed. And the very next day, having confessed in verse 14 of John chapter 6 that this is that prophet that comes into the world, the very next day, they said, why don't you perform a sign so that we can believe what you say? What they think they saw the day before. You think about batting your head against the wall. You know, you're presenting evidence, overwhelming, compelling evidence. And folks say, why don't you show us some evidence? Now, that's what Paul's dealing with here in the city of Athens. And he has to begin by establishing that there is a God. He's declaring unto them something they don't know. There is a God. And what does he do? He creates. Now, we could talk about this place where this speech takes place. They took him unto the Areopagus. Maybe you studied that, maybe you haven't. Sometimes you'll see a footnote in the American Standard Translation. The footnote is they took him to Mars Hill. Now, there was a place called Mars Hill, and there was a lot of conversion and teaching that took place up there on that hill. Obviously, it was kind of a place where you could be heard easily and that sort of thing. But also the term Areopagite or Areopagus described a court, a legal court. Now, whether or not Paul was taken before a legal court for some kind of proceeding for him to present what he has to say, it appears to be, at least if that is the case, that it was somewhat informal. Paul's not charged with anything. Or if it's simply to identify the place, Mars Hill, I can't be certain about that. But they took him to a place where he would be heard. And when they took him to the place to be heard, he stood in the midst of the Areopagus, and look at what he said. Ye men of Athens and all things, verse 22, I perceive that you are very religious. The King James translation uses the word superstitious. The word means to be in fear of deity. Now that's of particular interest to me. Because in this city you have men that have erected these temples for all these various idols, which indicates that they have some regard for deity as such, but that the universe has somehow created these objects of their worship. They've got this thing turned all backwards, you see. They've got gods that they fear, but these gods can't do anything. Everything has to be done for them. And that's going to be one of the points that Paul develops in this speech. But notice he said, I perceive that you're very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. What therefore you worship in ignorance, this I set forth unto you. Now again, I'm not persuaded that these people had any concept at all about who God is. He's just one of a multiple bunch that has resulted from the universe. And what do they know about him? Nothing. That's the point of emphasis here. There is a God that you don't know anything about. And what has He done? Look, if you will, at verse 24. It says, the God that made the world and all things therein, He being Lord of heaven and earth. Let's stop right there. What does this God that you don't know anything about, what does He do? He created. He created. And you see, you've got this thing in reverse. You've got the universe creating God. And that's not the way it is at all. God made the worlds and everything that's in them. And that just ran completely counter to their way of thinking. Am I out of time already? It does. Yes, Randy?
I'd like to hijack last few moments here and ask the class, today is a religious holiday. Does anybody know what it is?
I don't.
No one knows? Today's Pentecost.
Oh, well, I didn't know that.
My point in bringing that up is, when was Passover?
50 days ago.
Well, okay, what date is on the calendar this year?
I had to do math on that. Okay. April Fool's Day.
Right. That's okay. My point here is, when did Jesus ascend? If the calendar was the same then as today, when would Jesus have ascended? May 10th.
Yeah.
10 days ago. How long has it been in your mind since April 1st? A long time. Jesus spent between April 1st and May 10th with His disciples. As Peter says, we're not following cleverly designed fables.
Well, that's right.
They spent 40 days with Jesus, and they can confirm that he was risen from the dead.
That's right. That's right. And we're going to talk about that in the sermon a little bit more. From Acts chapter 1, verses 3 and 4.
Yeah.
Excellent. Something to think about.
Yep.